What I'm going to do is I'm going to speak on what I call the creation project. Creation project. So this is the first part of a study on the eschatology of the Old Testament. I'm going to talk about the eschatology of the Old Testament, at least up to a point, at least up to the covenant with Abraham. And I'll say a little bit about David, but not an awful lot. And I'm going to bring Jesus Christ into the discussion towards the end for a very important reason, because he's the one who kicks it off. He's the one who starts the process moving, and according to the New Testament, everything was made not only through him, but for him. So we can't speak about anything, really, the providence of God, the original creation, and the way that God is guiding the creation without speaking about Jesus Christ. It would be like speaking about something abstractly without talking about the person for whom it is all made and who gives it its center and gives it its purpose. So keep that in mind as we go through. This is a kind of an outline of some thinking that I've been doing over a number of years about how to approach the scriptures on the basis of a very simple starting point, which is God and what God has done, God and God's works. Because I do believe that we should see theology within that very simple grid. The person of God, who he is, who he's revealed himself to be, and what he is doing, and what he has done, and what he's going to do. And all of truth, not just biblical truth, not just gospel truth, every truth, past, present, and future, must be seen, I think, within the purview of the person of God, who has created it for himself, and who drives it, and who sustains it, and of course the works of God. What is he doing? What has he made? How do we interpret history in a theological perspective? Because only if we interpret history in a theological perspective will we interpret history correctly. It is important, I think, that we start to think like that as Christians. And so in speaking on the subject of the creation project, I want to make a number of basic points. First of all, that God created everything with a telos, with a goal, with a purpose in mind. And that man was meant to have an eminent part in that purpose. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that God is working that purpose out now and has told us about it. That is what we call eschatology, which I will define. The outworking of God's purpose towards that telos, towards that end, that is eschatology. Because we are supposed to reflect on that. And we're supposed to reflect on it not on the basis of what is going to happen in the future, but how God is moving us towards that future. You see that? Because if we just say, well, what's going to happen in the future, then we make the subject of eschatology an abstract thing, something that we can speculate about. It's off there in the future, you know. It doesn't impact us today. Whereas we ought to see it as something that God is moving this grudging creation and this grudging humanity towards. And sometimes it doesn't seem as though we're moving towards anything like final glorification or the reign of Christ. But we are moving towards this. And as Christians, I think we need to have that kind of mindset. Thirdly, that there are clear markers or signposts in the Old Testament which show us the route God is taking in subduing all things to himself and bringing them to that final end. And then fourthly, that Jesus Christ is the fulcrum through whom everything will be brought to perfect completion. And so we take not just a theological look at the world and where it's going, where it came from, but a Christological look too. All eschatology, because it's bound up to the one who made it and sustains it and who will return to judge it, is Christological. In fact, you cannot understand biblical truth unless you position biblical truth as something that is carried on by means of the cross of Christ. The cross of Christ is God's great signpost in the ground as to what he is going to do with the mess that's all around us. That the problem of evil, the problem of suffering, the problem of unfairness, the problem of untidiness in the world, all of the problems of mutation and of pain and disorder and of chaotic happenings in nature and in society, that all of these things will be done away with, will finally come under the thrall of the Prince of Peace. And they'll do that because of the cross. So the cross points you forward, you see. The cross also is something that you have to look back right at the very start, the very dawn of humanity. And you see that through the cross too. And the reason that you have to put the cross not just in a historical situation 2,000 years ago, but put it right at the beginning of the creation, is because the fall and all of the mess that is world history is part of God's plan. And so the promise of the Redeemer and the action of the Redeemer at the cross must be brought in so that you can interpret the forward thrust of the Old Testament and of the New Testament. Let's start with their definition then. Eschatology. This is all about the eschatology of the Old Testament. So what on earth is the word eschatology? What does it mean? Well, it comes from, of course, the Greek word eschatos. Would be a Greek word. So eschatos just means last, basically. And then logos, we know word, purpose, thought, idea, and so on. And so the idea of eschatology is a word or a thought about the last things. So when I say eschatology and eschatological, as I will in this paper, then I hope that you can see that what I'm referring to is this forward thrust that is built into creation and to which God is guiding the world. The first thing then on this study of the creation project is that creation must be viewed as a project. I think many of us, when we open the first chapter of Genesis, we see that it starts with the Holy Spirit brooding over the face of the waters and God saying, let there be light. And then we have a sequence, don't we, up until the sixth day and the second part of the sixth day where God creates man in his own image. And then God rests from his work. And we think, well, that's it. Creation is a past thing, and it is. And it was perfect because God said it was very good. And the next thing that we know, it's all ruined by Adam and Eve. The problem with that is that it really doesn't answer the question as to why God created it in the first place. What was the creation for? And if the creation was for something, then did the event of the fall make God have second thoughts about what he was doing? Did it come as a surprise to God? Did it wake God up so that he had to quickly put together another plan? If we answer no to those, and we ought to, if we believe that God is all-powerful and all-knowing, then we need to go back again and ask this question, okay, well, what's it all for then? What's God doing? What is the purpose? And so let's have a look then quickly, viewing creation as a project. The first thing that I want to say is pretty obvious. In fact, a lot of this is pretty obvious. And the first thing is that God created personally. He created personally. You say, well, wow, there's a profound truth. Who doesn't know that? Well, every biblical Christian knows that God created personally. But they don't realize the implications of that. The implications of God creating this material world and all of the different things in it, all of the life forms, all of the trees, all of the planets, all of the interconnections between things, all of the laws of science and so on, which hold the thing together, and that God was personally interested and involved and chose personally to put this thing here, to make this grow here, to make this feed on this, to make this dependent on that, that flourish in relation to this other thing, to be held together in a certain way, and to look a certain way, to be appreciated in a certain way by the onlooker of the wonder that he's made, man. And so there's a personal aspect to creation. When God says creation is very good, that means that he thought that the physical world that he made was good. That means that it wasn't something that was less good than the spiritual. That means that the physical world is, in and of itself, a good thing. There's nothing wrong with physicality. There's nothing wrong with the material realm. Now, to listen to some Christians, you'd think there was. We talked about some of the early church fathers a little earlier. And you can't read the church fathers without running into this kind of view that there's something wrong with the material realm. You know, nearly all, if not all, of the great fathers of the church were all aesthetics. And that means that they believed that you had to do something to the body to kind of put it down, to restrict it in some way. And so they were all very much on aesthetics. You know, abstaining from this, not doing that. It's not a good thing to be a preacher, to be a pastor, and to be married. And things like this, you see. Really, really put upon the body, put upon the material aspect, because that encourages the spiritual, which is really the most important thing. And this kind of thinking, this dichotomy between the body and the soul, has continued in Christianity up until the present day. It's a very unhealthy thing. It's a very unbiblical thing. So God created personally. Now if you think about how that impacts the world view that Christians should hold, I think that you come to the realization that that is quite profound, because in the thought of, say, the religion of Islam, which is, I suppose, to most onlookers, the religion that's closest in its theology to Christianity, you have Allah, and you have Allah who's not at all interested in personally getting involved with his creation or with his creature. He's very aloof. He doesn't want to be known. He cannot be known. Not in and of himself. The only thing that can be known is his will. And so there's no personal interest by Allah in the material realm. Now, because there's no personal interest by the Creator in the material realm, that kind of trickles down to the people that worship that Creator. Do you see? And they don't have much of an interest in the material realm either. For example, there's no mandate, no cultural or creation mandate in Islam that tells you to go out and subdue the world and analyze it and to see God's wonders in it, to do science, in other words. And of course, if you look at the monist religions on Hindu or Buddhism, some of the New Age stuff, well, they very often say, well, all is one. You see, all is one. I'm you, you and me, we're all God. I'm this table, the table is me. And if I take a drink, it's God putting God into God. Okay? And we just understand this, then all of the different struggles and all the different pains that are involved in seeing things as different and varied go away, because all is one. I'm you, you and me. So there's no struggle involved. But of course, also what we have is that we have absolutely no interest in helping people, because the people who are, it seems, more unfortunate than us are just us. And the world, well, that's just us too. So there's no reason to do any science in that worldview. You say, well, you're kind of losing me here. You don't need to see through the ramifications to see the power of this kind of thinking. Just look at what used to be called the Third World. Just look at those countries like India and China before it basically took over some of the mindset of the West, and the way that their cultures developed or didn't develop. No interest in the created realm, you see? So it's very important that we see that because our God cares about the world he created, there is a big impetus, a big cognitive push within the Christian worldview for us to be interested in the creation too. We should be the people who are the most conscientious about the environment. Why? Well, because we are supposed to be good stewards of God's environment. This is God's. This is God's creation. We're supposed to look after it. A good reason, therefore, within the Christian worldview, to make sure that we take care of the environment. Not that we go around hugging trees or caring about every lesser spotted variety of woodpecker that might be in danger. You know, some of these things come and go. But we have to be responsible. Why? Because creation is God's and God's doing something with it and we're supposed to be part of it. Okay. God, therefore, created personally. He also created for a purpose. It is vital that we realize that God did not have to make the material universe of stars and planets and oceans and trees. That he did, and that he said it was very good, is highly significant. C.S. Lewis once said, God likes matter. He created it. You see, many Christians have got this very unhealthy idea that God is guiding this world not towards a physical end. No, we've got to do away with the physical world. We've got to do away with the physical kingdom. You know, this physical kingdom is at odds with the spiritual. It's all about heaven. It's all about this spiritual, ethereal existence. That's what eternal bliss is. And for many Christians, that's what they think heaven is. That's what they think God is guiding creation to. But can you see that that does not at all deal with the issue of why God created the physical universe in the first place and called it very good? If it was very good and he bothered to create it and put us upon it, so that we could appreciate it and do something with it, then surely what he's going to bring it to is a permanent state of physical perfection. Not that he's going to cast it away. I hope you can see that there are real implications for eschatology about the way we approach the physical world. By all biblical accounts, God created a material world carefully and purposefully. He was not arbitrary in his work. This world is not some kind of second thought in God. It is not inferior to the spiritual realm. It is not less good than the spirit realm. God created this world lovingly and deliberately, and he set it on a course. And that's the course that we call eschatology. You say, when are you going to get onto eschatology? I'm actually teaching you eschatology right now. You just haven't been taught it this way, probably. But it's important that you see eschatology in these terms. You go right back to the very creation before you can understand the future. I think it's important that we think this way. And so, he created the world lovingly, deliberately, and he created beings to put on it and to populate it who could not only do certain jobs within the ecology of the material world, but who could actually look up from the ground and away from each other and actually contemplate the world and its beauty and its proportions, its color, its order, its texture. And they could explore it. And in exploring it, they could find the things that God had placed within it. And in finding those things and analyzing those things and seeing how they worked, say a flower or a fish or whatever, and looking at these things, they could respond and give glory to the Creator. And that's what our role is. That's why God put us in the world. So that we would vocalize the creation's praise back to God. And we are physical. And the world is physical. God did not put us in the world and make everything around us and say, there you are, it's done. There's nothing more to do. Just sit around and enjoy yourselves. No, God gave the original man and woman something to do, didn't he? He gave them a creation or cultural mandate in Genesis chapter 1. And this was repeated also to Noah later on. We're told here, go from verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. What are those things that he's just named? Those are the things he's just created. Do you see that? So man, who is made in the image of God, is made to have a dominion, a purpose over the rest of the creation. You could say that this physical creation was in a very real way made for man. I'm not very much into the man-woman language, calling us humankind, stuff like that. The Bible doesn't do that, so I don't do that. I hope that that's not offensive to anybody. And verse 27 says, God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. Okay, so when I'm talking about man, I'm talking about male and female. Look at this. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and every other living thing that moves on the earth. And God says, look, I've given you all of these things. And also, in chapter 2, he has Adam name the animals. God doesn't name the animals. Adam names the animals. In naming, he has authority over them, shows the authority. Also, in analyzing them, shows that man is to explore. He's to look at the creation of God. He's to see what God has put in it. He's to learn as he looks and as he tries to describe and name things. All of this, then, is built into the ongoing purpose of the creation in the first place. In other words, although creation was very good at the start, it was not complete. It had a built-in eschatology. Can you see that? A built-in movement towards a consummation. That's what I'm saying. As the Oxford ethicist Oliver O'Donovan says in his book, Resurrection and Moral Order, quote, because the created order is given, because God has put it there, we can see it, because it is secure, because God has made it for a purpose and he's taking it to a final end, we dare to be certain that God will vindicate it in history. That's a very powerful idea. Because the created order is given by God, because it is secure, because it's secured by God, it's made by God for God, and we've been placed on it, then we dare to be certain that God will vindicate the created order in history. And we should be looking at that as we interact with it. Indeed, we can be sure that God will bring creation to a glorious end. Just as the Bible tells us, he will. History is moving towards a wonderful consummation in which both the physical realm and the spiritual realm will be united in one extraordinary eschatological kingdom. This is why in 1 Corinthians 15, when Paul is describing the bodily resurrection of believers at the end times, he describes that physical body as what? A spiritual body. Because he does not see that this physical cannot be spiritual. No, he's looking for a time when the physical is truly united with the spiritual in glorification. And of course, Romans chapter 8, if you're aware of that, and I'm sorry we don't have a lot of time to actually dig into these chapters, but in Romans chapter 8, we're told that the creation, the whole created order, is eagerly awaiting the manifestation, that is the physical deliverance, glorification of the children of God. Because Adam is tied to the ground, because he's over the created order, our glorification and the glorification of the world, of the universe, are tied together. And can you see, therefore, again, the importance of the cross in understanding the forward movement of the final glorification, the final purpose of creation? So God did not create a consummated world, but a world in need of completing. Now, God created a good world, but the world that was good and sinless needed developing by man. God placed an inbuilt potential within creation, which man was to bring out. And in fulfilling the creation mandate, man would fulfill his own potential as God's vice-regent in this world. Man has become more of what God wanted him to be under God. Now we've gone away from God and we've become less than what we were supposed to be, you see? Which is why, being born again, we want to become more like God, more like Christ. Which again is part of that eschatology, isn't it? It's part of that forward push that we find in our own lives. So this means, therefore, that even before the fall, in Eden, in paradise, there was an inbuilt eschaton, or forward movement, to which God wanted man, under his sovereignty, under his kingship, to bring the world into. Thus, in studying the creation story, we are driven to an eschatological view of history. This means that if we're going to study eschatology at all, we have to say history is moving from point A to point Z. It's got to be linear. Do you see? It's got to be forward-looking. It cannot repeat itself. It cannot be a wheel of karma. It has to move from one historical point to another historical point. Otherwise, God's purpose in making the created order and giving it the potential will not be realized. And this eschatological tone, this forward movement, is made more necessary because of the fall. Because the fall didn't push it forward, did it? It didn't jump us forward in the program. It knocked everything back. It made God curse the world. It made us independent from God, going our own way. And therefore, there was more work to do to bring the creation to where God wants it to be. So Christ comes in, as we've said, his vicarious death for our sin and his bodily resurrection for our justification comprise the final solution to the creation project and the solution to the present world in its desperate state. And the second coming of Christ is our hope, and the hope of the whole world. And so it's vital that we understand future events in terms of the original creation purpose. That's why I've kind of been spending so long on this, because to some of you it might be a new way of thinking about the world, about our place in the world, and about the end times. Christ is the framer of creation in the first place. In humbling himself and coming into the world, he becomes the final representative man who, in taking the place of sinners, is the cause of the salvation not only of man, but of man's environment, the whole created order. Okay, let's look at the fall quickly. I'm going to try and move a little bit quicker here and see what kind of intrusion this was. Genesis chapter 3. The first thing that we must say about the fall is that it was an appointed intrusion. For all of its devastation, it was appointed by God. It didn't catch God napping. God was not out playing golf somewhere in the other part of the universe while the serpent crept into the garden and started a conversation with Eve. He knew exactly what he was doing. He put the tree there, he put the prohibition there, and he let the serpent in. It was pre-planned. So we must see the fall as a planned interruption that introduced new elements into the fulfillment program of the created order. Now these were not good elements, but they were new elements. The forward thrust, which is in the original creation, and which is enhanced by the making of man in the image of God, receives, though, because of this retrograde step of the fall, not less impetus, but more impetus and more renewed emphasis because of the fall. It is absolutely crucial because of the fall and its devastation and its pain and its suffering that God does something to change it, to beautify it, to glorify it, to rectify it. You see that? The fact of the fall destroying so much of the pristine glory of nature and of man does not curtail God's original intention. The fall implies an eschatology. It's right at the very root of it, if you believe God's involved. The original cultural mandate needs to be fulfilled, and the created sphere needs to be corrected. God has not had to rethink his plan due to unforeseen repudiation of him and his claims on the world by his creatures. The calamity into which we fell is experienced by the whole creation because of its link to man as its ruler and the fact that everything's subject to man. And the fall incapacitated us to do anything about changing that curse, changing that ruin. So the fall introduces complete disorder, complete corruption, and any change must come from outside of man, thus bringing in the necessity of a deliverer. Man cannot save himself. It is impossible. With this view of creation and fall, we cannot do anything to change it, because we're part of the problem. In fact, we're right at the very center of the problem. And so there are real implications for the doctrine of creation as it is impacted by the ongoing effects of the fall. The fall spoiled the creation of God. And so creation and providence must deal with it. This fallen world is in need of saving, or what Jesus refers to as regeneration in Matthew 19:28. Talks about the regeneration when the disciples will sit upon 12 thrones judging the tribes of Israel. This world's redemption is never fully accomplished. There's another interesting fact of this eschatology. Now, our redemption is fully accomplished in our glorification, in our being made like Christ. We will see him and we will be like him. This world's redemption is never fully accomplished. That's why God has to make a new heavens and a new earth. And I think that's an interesting thing. I haven't got my mind about why it's necessary for God to make a new heavens and a new earth. All I can say is that it really does bear thinking about, that question, because it means that whatever God is doing in this time frame with this physical world surely cannot end in some kind of cataclysmic failure. So that God is drawn to finally throw the plans away in despair and start all over again. Surely God's got a purpose in the created order. Surely he's taking history somewhere. And this history, when it finally reaches its final age or its final day, is going to say something back to man about God. Isn't it? And that would mean, to me, that there has to be some kind of a final eschatological, physical kingdom in the world which vindicates God before God dispenses with it and creates a new heavens and a new earth. So the physical world, this present physical world, is depicted as groaning, Romans 8:22, in anticipation of our final redemption so it can reach its optimum level of glory and beauty before the recreation of the new heavens and the new earth. This requires, in my view, a premillennial view of history. Because an amillennial view that says that we're in the kingdom now doesn't answer this eschatological push. It doesn't give you anything at the end to glorify himself, to vindicate himself in the present creation project. Perhaps some of you can see a little bit of what I'm saying. Maybe this is too new to you that you can't see what I'm saying, but it's being recorded, so maybe you can listen to it again and try and think through this again. But because man was made to be the governor under God of the material realm and is made from the dust, then the connection between man and the material world is something that affects the material world when man is glorified. So, the fact that this world is under a curse does not mean that the world is to be given up upon. Does not mean that this physical world has no hope. does not mean that we shouldn't find in the Bible some intimations of this future regeneration of the physical realm, and that we shouldn't look for it. So as a premillennialist, I believe that this earth must be brought completely back under the sway of the Lord, the final representative man, if the creation project is to be finalized. And that will happen in the millennium when the Lord Jesus Christ himself sets up rule in Jerusalem, which is his chosen city. Okay, moving on a little bit more here. Those were my two major points. Now I can go more quickly through these next points. The cleansing and overthrow of the original order. You see, there was another interruption. Not just the fall, but there was another interruption. God allowed the fall. He thrust Adam and Eve out of the garden so they wouldn't have access to the tree of life. But, as we know, Cain and Abel were soon in dispute. Well, Cain was in dispute with Abel. The first murder. Lamech bragging about murders. The world getting worse and worse until, in Genesis chapter 6, God is fed up with the whole thing. And it even says that it repents God, that he's made man upon the earth. An emotive feeling there, not that God is having second thoughts, but talking about the emotion that God feels, about the devastation of man, about the backwardness of man. And so he brings a flood. That's another interruption. He wipes the whole thing out and starts again with eight people. Well, with one person, really, one representative man. Adam was the first representative man and was given a mandate and messed up. And so we start with another representative man, Noah. It doesn't take him very long to mess up. But we know that to Noah, God restates the privileged position of man. He gives him the creation mandate. There are some things that have changed. And the importance of keeping the same progressive linear view of history is reiterated in Genesis 8:22, so that Noah knows he's got a job to do under God. And so the world starts again. But what happens? Well, a few generations down the road, they're all of one language, and they decide that it'd be a jolly good idea if they congregate together and build a monument to themselves. And the idea, of course, was an early form of secular humanism that was coming in. We shall be our own God here. I mean, the United Nations is not a new idea. And so the Tower of Babel episode introduces what? Not just a physical devastation, but now a cognitive confusion as well into this ongoing plan. You would think that it wasn't eschatology at all, wouldn't you? You would think that God, in bringing these fits and starts into his created order, had no purpose at all. He didn't know what he was doing. But we mustn't view history that way. We must see that God is saying something to us in these failures of man. Now, in this, by the way, I'm not particularly concerned at all about the old dispensational issue of a dispensation lasting for a certain amount of time that we look back upon and ending in failure. I'm not really concerned about that. Whether that's true or not, I don't care, really. What I'm concerned about is something I think is a little bit more interesting than that, and that has to do with answering the question as to, well, God just gets going pretty well, man gets going pretty well, and then bam, everything goes to pieces. And the Tower of Babel is another one of those issues. What's so devastating about the Tower of Babel? Man comes together, and he's idolatrous. God comes down, and he deals with man by messing up man's language, bringing in confusion into this place where man wants to come together and to make sure that they stay together. God smites their language so that they're each speaking different languages. God is the creator of language, by the way. Language didn't come from toots and whistles. There's a biblical view of language. And so God comes down, and within seconds, he has given different peoples different languages by his divine power, with all of the complexities and complications and so on that language involves. God's just done it like that. And so they start talking to each other and they can't understand each other. And so that means that, well, I can't talk to you anymore. I've got to talk to somebody I can understand. And as they go to the different groups, they start to not only communicate, but they start to think, because words carry thoughts. So the thinking of the different language groups starts to diverge. Do you see that? And as the thinking diverges, this means that different world views, different religions, different explanations for why we're here and why the world is here start to come to the fore. So, man is another mess. So because of this, God has to narrow the focus of his purposes down to another representative man, Abraham. You see, he allows just enough time for the mess to really settle in before choosing Abraham. And then calls Abraham out of that mess to a land where he's going to, in a sense, start again. Although it's not another start, it's just another part of the eschatological program that God has always had. And from this representative man, God is going to form another community to offset the community that's away from him. This community is provided with a mandate in the shape of the Abrahamic covenant. Abraham is the chosen man from the chosen race, Shem, Genesis 9:26. This covenant also includes the elements of promise by which God's program is ensured against collapse. The Abrahamic covenant includes the elements of other covenants, including the new covenant through which, of course, everything is going to be renewed, everything is going to be saved, everything is going to be finally glorified through Christ, so that the final eschatological creation project will be finalized in the future. The covenant provisions are not to remind God that he's got a job to finish. No, these covenant provisions are to remind the faithful of the intent of God to restore harmony between himself and mankind, and between mankind and the world. In other words, to complete what he started back in Genesis 1. This means, and I can't say very much about this, and you'll be pleased about that, because I've gone on for a little while, but this means that this covenant, because it's not for God, it's for man, has got to be understood by man. It requires that man study this covenant and the covenants that are related to it and understand what God is doing. God has told him. These are the signposts, par excellence. And again, you might disagree with me, but I believe that in the Abrahamic covenant, we have a number of different promises that we have to take seriously. Not only the personal promises to Abraham, but we have promises of a land given to the literal seed, not only to Abraham, but through Isaac and Jacob. Okay? Jacob was renamed by God Israel. And so there are promises that involve that aspect through the blessing of Shem. Then there are promises that involve not just ethnic Israel, the remnant, if you like, but the Gentiles too, which is realized, of course, through the final eschatological representative man, who's Jesus Christ, who doesn't fail, who doesn't mess up, but will bring everything, guide everything to its final consummation. And of course, we have the Davidic covenant, which is given kind of halfway through that time, whereby Christ's kingship is set up, both over the eschatological land of the Shemites of Israel, but also to the Gentiles as well. And the new covenant in Christ's cross is the means by which all of the provisions of the Abrahamic covenant and those covenants that are related to it are brought to the final consummation in that final physical kingdom. You see, we must, to me, relate all of this to the physical realm. The creation demands it. Because God's got something he's doing. And it doesn't involve, right at the end, going, oh my goodness, that didn't work out. Let's all go spiritual now. Let's all get up to heaven and just not forget about the earth. It must involve the world and everything that God had in mind. God knows what he's doing. And God is surely bringing about the purpose that he had in mind when he pronounced the original creation. I want to say something very quickly about these representative men, just to review. I do not, first of all, want to say that the representatives, Adam, Noah, Abraham, David, Jesus, are all of equal significance. They're not. The New Testament makes it clear that in an important sense, there are only two representatives of humanity, Adam and Christ. Christ is the second Adam, and will return and trigger the start of the completion of the eschaton. And I actually worded that very carefully. The start of the completion of the eschaton. That means when Christ comes the first time, the eschaton really started to kick in. Not just at the second coming, but at the first coming too. This is why John 5:24 and places like that are so important. Being taken out of one kingdom, put into another. Adam Christ, Romans 5:12-21. Taken out of Adam, put in Christ. Delivered from the power of darkness and placed into the kingdom of God's dear Son. These ideas, you see, all come with the first coming of Christ. But the first coming of Christ is connected with the second coming of Christ, which is also physical. And we must bring these together and keep them in the created realm. Let's not all have the whole mess being taken to heaven and earth being completely forgotten about. Very quickly. Adam was given a work to complete, but he introduced a curse. Noah was given a mandate too. He was given a work to do. And he was given a covenant. As the head of the new humanity, he was given a covenant that covered the new humanity and man's relation to that creation. But it failed at the Tower of Babel. Abraham was chosen. He was given a promise, and that promise was sealed in a contract, in a covenant. David was God's chosen, a man after God's own heart. He also received a promise, and he too was given a covenant. And then Christ, who is the second Adam, but who Noah and Abraham and David all converge in, are all aspects of their representative roles in Christ. Christ comes along, and he becomes the fulfiller of the mandates given to Adam and Noah particularly, and of the promises given to Abraham and David. And he brings them all together. He will lift the curse and usher in the perfected culmination of the creation project. And so we haven't dealt with perhaps what you thought I might deal with. Looking into the prophets, looking into the book of Revelation, and so on and so forth. What I've tried to do in this talk is just get you to see that this idea of eschatology, this idea of the future, is connected with the past. It's connected with the question, why did God create in the first place? And I believe that the answer can only be finally understood on the basis of a final culmination, a glorification of the literal physical world under God himself in the person of the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ, who is the Lord of Lords and King of Kings. Thank you.